Good evening. I would like to welcome everybody listening all around the world, all across the United States. We are live from the City of Angels, the bright, shining light that is Coast to Coast AM, those studios right here in Los Angeles, California. I'm your host on this Saturday night, Jimmy Church, continuing through the weekend and into Sunday morning. Today is December 17th. And yeah, okay, I'm just going to say it. Tis the season. Well, for most of us anyway, kind of is. And for some reason, when I get around to this time of year, I always think about Charlie Brown Christmas. Yeah, I do. And I have the CD, right? I play the songs, and I listen to it often. It's actually about as good as it gets, right? And the memories that it brings me are the best. They're my best. And at this point, I don't even know how many of those memories are even real, right? It doesn't matter. Probably a good dose of the Mandela effect is in play, but we'll save all of that for another show. But another thing that happens around this time of year is the subject of Jesus, right? You know what I'm talking about, the whole thing. The three wise men, frankincense, and myrrh. What is myrrh anyway? You know, the manger, the star. We all know the story. At least, we think we do, right? You get it. Well, the first time that I heard Ralph Ellis and started reading his books and just listening to his presentations, I knew that this was someone that I needed to reach out to. It's what I do. Knowledge and the thirst, the quest, right? His thorough and extensive research into history and specifically with Jesus was and is, to me, a potential game changer. He's that good. And the ties to the legend and mythology of King Arthur with Jesus, for me, closed the deal. Seriously, well, at least for me. Ralph is a guy you need to listen to. So tonight, open your ears. Listen closely to what Ralph has to say. Take notes, and then go and follow up with your own research. This is going to be one of those shows that you'll remember. It'll become one of your fondest December memories. I promise. And why is that? Because first up tonight, we have Howard Bloom with us, regular here on Coast, and also one of the brightest guys in the business. And tonight, we're going to discuss his new book, The Muhammad Code, How a Desert Prophet Brought You ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Boko Haram. It's time to get our learn on. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. You know the drill. You can follow me right now on Twitter at JChurchRadio. For any questions or comments during the show, I keep Twitter live to my left. It's running in real time. Stay right there. Saturday night, this is Coast to Coast, and I'll be right back with my first guest, Howard Bloom. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host tonight, Jimmy Church. And I wanted to say really quick before we start the show tonight, congratulations to Chris Boros, one of our producers here at Coast to Coast, and I understand he got married today. So, congrats, Chris. There you go. All right, Howard Bloom. He's been called the next in a lineage of seminal thinkers that includes Newton, Darwin, Einstein, and Freud. That was by Britain's Channel 4 TV. And, of course, the next Stephen Hawking by Gear Magazine. And I've always wanted to say this. I'm so excited to have Howard on the show tonight. And the Buckminster Fuller and Arthur C. Clarke of the New Millennium. There you go. Howard is the author of Global Brain, The Evolution of Mass Mind from the Big Bang to the 21st Century. Of course, Reinventing Capitalism, The Lucifer Principle, The Genius of the Beast, The God Problem. Great book. His new book is The Muhammad Code, How a Desert Prophet Brought You ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Boko Haram. And I would like to welcome back our good friend, Howard Bloom. Howard, good evening.
Jimmy, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
It's great to have you back on. And, you know, I'm just going to say this for real, Howard. I've always wanted to do that introduction for you.
That's wonderful.
I mean,
absolutely terrific.
So there you go.
Right.
Here we are. We've got a lot to discuss tonight about the new book, but I think this is what's most important. 2016, I'm kind of glad this year is behind us. A lot of great things happened this year, but a lot of crazy things. And one of those was the constant pummeling of breaking ISIS news and crazy videos and just things that were really bumming people out, including myself. I found it difficult to continue to report on it and to read it and to see it as well. But how did ISIS grow so fast? Was it something to do with the smartness of technology and taking advantage of pop culture? Do you think that had a lot to do with it? It expanded so fast.
It had everything to do with a big mistake we made in 2003. And the last chapter of this book is about how the Iranians suckered us into the war in Iraq. You know, we thought there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We were absolutely certain of it. We were so certain that the Prime Minister of England swore that he had documentary evidence that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It wasn't just us. The fact is that this was phony information that we were fed by the Iranians. And the Iranians basically wanted to take over Iraq. They had tried it with a war from 1982 to 1988. That it cost $1 trillion. It had killed 1 million people, and they got nowhere. They ended up in a stalemate. So they chose another approach, a less expensive approach. Remember the ad, "Let's Let Mikey Do It"?
Right.
Life, this ghastly cereal, and these five-year-olds sitting around deciding that they were going to let their naive two-and-a-half-year-old brother try the stuff for the first time. Well, it was the "Let's Let Mikey Do It" strategy. In other words, let's concoct a whole bunch of very, very well fabricated misinformation that proves unequivocally that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Let's leak them to Congress, to the CIA, to the White House, to 60 Minutes, to everybody that we can find of influence in North America. And then let's let Mikey do it. Let's let the United States spend trillions of or billions of dollars, actually came out to about $3 trillion by the time it was all over, on Iraq. Let's let them knock off Saddam Hussein, and once they knock off Saddam Hussein, we can take over the country. The problem is this led to a huge power vacuum, and it led to a power vacuum at about the time that Facebook, Twitter, well, the internet had been around for quite a while. They were all coming to prominence. And the result was that a guy named Zarqawi could move in to Iraq in the empty zones. He could enlist the people who had been fired. Remember, we fired everybody who'd been hired by Saddam Hussein, which meant the entire army. There was an entire army full of people without jobs that you could bring into your organization. Zarqawi did that with an organization called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And he was monstrous. He was bloodthirsty. And the organization that he started in this empty vacuum that we left in Iraq, and we left it, by the way, well before Barack Obama came into office, the organization that he put together evolved into ISIS.
That vacuum, and I think all of us remember when we were looking at the dismantling of the Iraqi army, and you're wondering to yourself, is this really a good idea? Right?
Well, we found out.
Right.
We really did, because we were hit with, there were anywhere from 100 to 1,000 people being killed a day, innocent civilians were being killed because there were car bombings, there were donkey bombings, there were bicycle bombings, there were motorcycle bombings, and they were concentrated in Baghdad, but they were taking place all over the place. And we kept hearing that these were coming from insurgents. Well, those insurgents were the former guys from the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein's party, the guys from his military organization, the top guys from his military organization, who joined groups like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which eventually became ISIS. The trick is that, you know, Islam, I have tons of friends who are Muslims. I adore them. They are some of the most tolerant, pluralist, wonderful, creative people that I know. I do Saudi television, I do Iranian television all the time. My producer is just fabulous. The Sheikh who made Dubai what it is today has named a racehorse after one of my books. The 11th president of India, who is a Muslim, has called my stuff a visionary creation. But there are two sides to Islam because there are two sides to Muhammad. One was Muhammad, who was peaceful, who was into getting along with other people, who was into tolerance and acceptance. That was when Mecca was living, or in Muhammad was living in his hometown of Mecca. Then he thought that the Meccans were out to kill him, and maybe they were. They were getting very unhappy with him. So he fled, and he fled to a town 280 miles away called Yathrib. It's now known as Medina. And in that tiny town, he decided that, well, he was a guest. You know how long house guests welcome lasts, about 2 days.
Right.
And then people begin to resent them. So he had to do something to pay off the people who were allowing him and his tiny little band of followers to live in their community. And he chose a path that was, well, questionable. He decided, okay, Mecca makes its money through camel caravans, through sending caravans, taking goods like frankincense and myrrh, the stuff you were talking about when you were talking about Jesus,
right,
from Yemen, where it came from, over on the near the Indian Ocean, all the way over to the Mediterranean basin. They made tons of money in Mecca doing that. Well, the Meccan caravans, after they went to Syria, which is where they dropped off their goods in the Mediterranean region, where they sold them for high prices, came back with the money. And it was a tradition that you do not attack caravans because everybody's business relies on them. And Muhammad decided, okay, I'll get my guys together, a merry band, and we will start attacking caravans. And that's what Muhammad did, and his men got carried away, and they started killing people. And the result was a darker side of Muhammad came out, a side that was dedicated to war, a side that was dedicated to killing. It turned out that Muhammad loved killing. He really, really enjoyed it. It's horrible to read the stories. And basically, this book, The Muhammad Code, How a Desert Prophet Brought You ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Boko Haram, or How Muhammad Invented Jihad, is about that dark side of Muhammad, because that dark side of Muhammad explains the Paris massacre, it explains Orlando, it explains the San Bernardino killings, it explains the kid in Ohio, who was just 2 weeks ago at Ohio State. This was one of the most wonderful kids in the world. You and I would have adored him. He was top of his class. He graduated magna cum laude from a community college. Everybody, the other students, all said he came to class with the best questions because he was always the best prepared. And then he snapped. And why did he snap? Because he'd been prepared by the example of Muhammad, because in Islam there is a strange thing, and it is that the picture of propriety, the way to be righteous, the way to be just, is to follow Muhammad's life step by step by step, and do everything he did. And during his Meccan phase, he was a good guy. And during his Medina phase, he commanded 65 military campaigns. He personally led 27 of them. He emptied his entire arrow case and broke his bow, trying to shoot as many enemy combatants as possible. And he expanded the territory of his burgeoning empire by 317 square miles a day, which is just flat out astonishing.
Yeah, it is that. And let me jump in there for a second, Howard. The way that, and when you look at the historical record and the way that he was able to expand, I mean, just go from a few dozen guys to a couple of hundred to really large, 30, very, yeah.
30,000 during his lifetime.
That's right. It was rapid. And I see the same parallels with the way that ISIS expanded so quickly in just a few short years right in front of us, and it seemed like we couldn't stop them. They're so remarkably similar, it's beyond words.
Well, it's partly because kids in the Islamic world, there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, and kids in the Islamic world are taught the stories of Muhammad, including the stories of his battles. Plus, every Muslim has to get together with another group of Muslims and pray five times a day. There's this thing called muscular bonding. One of the great historians, William McNeil, has written an entire book called something like Dancing and Drill in History. And it's about how when you drill people together, when you make them do simultaneous physical moves, there's something he calls muscular bonding. Now, think of this, 5 times a day, 7 days a week, all your life, you are engaged in muscular bonding and in the practice of lining up in what are called files and bowing to Mecca. And you can imagine yourself as part of a global movement because you imagine yourself at exactly the same time as everybody else, because the whole Muslim community globally is synced. There are apps for this on your cell phone these days that tell you exactly when to pray, so you're in sync with every other Muslim, including people on the opposite face of the earth. All these people are bowing simultaneously, aware of the fact that they are part of something infinitely bigger than themselves. And ranks and files are essential in war, and they're essential in the kind of military strategy that Islam used. And you're right, as a consequence, Islam seemed to explode. I mean, today, these kids are still educated this way. So if you tap them, the kid at the Ohio State attacker, though he didn't succeed, thank God, in killing anybody, said that every single Muslim who disapproves of my actions is a sleeper cell waiting for a signal. He was talking about the fact that everybody in Islam is trained, every male in Islam is trained to be, if necessary, a part of a military unit. The result was Muhammad died in 632 AD. The two superpowers of the time were the Roman Empire, centered in Byzantium. Byzantium at the time was called the New Rome, and the Persian Empire. And they were huge. There was nothing like them on the face of the earth. Within 4 years of Muhammad's death, the Persian Empire, a superpower on a par with the United States or the old Soviet Union, had fallen and was made Islamic. Nothing like that has ever happened in history. Eventually, not that much eventually, over the course of the next 70 years or so, Islam took an empire 11 times the size of the conquests of Alexander the Great, 5 times the size of the Roman Empire. Think of that. That's the size of 5 Roman empires, and 7 times the size of the United States, the biggest empire in the history of the world. Nothing like it has ever existed, had ever existed before, and nothing like it has existed since.
Now, it seems to have slowed down, right? The expansion in Syria, now I'm just talking about right. mainstream media and how it's right. portrayed, that the tide has turned, certainly in Iraq it has, and in Syria, but for the last 3 years, completely out of control and appeared to catch us all by surprise. How did they pull that off?
It was catching us by surprise, and it was happening all over the place. It was happening all the way from Asia to Africa. A swath of about 2,000 to 3,000 miles. They pulled it off without us realizing it, in part because they've convinced us there's this campaign. The Organization of Islamic Countries is a group of 57 Islamic nations. It's the second biggest intergovernmental body on the face of the earth. The first is the UN, the second is the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. In the 1990s, they started working on a plan to get us to shut ourselves up. To get us to censor ourselves. And at first they did it by using a word that had been used by Jews against anti-Semitism, defamation. And that word really didn't work for them. And then they latched on a word that did work, Islamophobia. And they convinced us that to say anything negative about Islam at all is forbidden. It's a form of disease. It's irrational. It has nothing to do with reality. And they shut us up in particular about the story of Muhammad's life and the 65 battles that he led and the 27 military expeditions where he put on two coats of chain mail, girded on his sword, made sure he had a full arrow case, and went out to, in the words of the Ayatollah Khomeini, the guy who founded modern Iran, our great men went into battle to kill and be killed. And the great man he's talking about is Muhammad. We shut our eyes to this entire story of the militant part of Muhammad's life, and we shut our eyes to all of the militant activities going on all over the world, and we're still shutting our eyes. The people at the Washington Post don't know the story in this book. The people at the New York Times do not know the story in this book. This is a book you are not supposed to read, Jimmy, and it is all taken from Islamic sources that every school child has at least some connection with while he's growing up.
Yeah, and certainly all religions are almost guilty of, or most, I should say, of the very same things, too. Very violent history, absolutely.
Sort of.
This is, we got to take a break right here. You know the drill, Howard. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. It is Saturday night, And we're talking with the one and only Howard Bloom. We'll be right back right after this. Stay with us. All right, our guests tonight, Howard Bloom and Ralph Ellis. Ralph will be with us shortly. But before we get back to Howard, I want you to check out Beyond Belief, where you can join Coast to Coast AM's George Norrie for those dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained. You can see the world through new eyes. You get new episodes weekly. You get unlimited access to Beyond Belief and watch anywhere on your computer, your iPhone, your iPad. No commercials, no sponsors. Enjoy Beyond Belief completely ad-free. Just go to beyondbelief.com. My guest, Howard Bloom. His new book, The Muhammad Code. We'll pick up more with Howard right after this short break. Stay with us. All right, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. You can follow me on Twitter tonight at JChurch Radio. Any questions or comments during the show, I keep Twitter live to my left. It's real time. And if it's a good tweet, maybe I'll read it on the air. All right, Howard, one of the points that I think is very important here is how ISIS just took advantage of technology with Twitter and YouTube and the internet and Facebook. And nobody seemed to know how to stop them. And that's part of a young mind, right? They understood technology where we were probably a couple steps behind.
They had breathtakingly good designers. They write copy extremely well. Their art direction is superb. It's magnificent. And they know how to do weird stuff like steganographic codes, which are codes that are hidden in your computer screen. They know how to work the system so that they get around whatever barriers we try to set up. But I want to get to something that you brought up just before the break, because it was a very important point. You said that all the major religions in the world have their darker side, and that's true. But there's a difference between militant Islam, between jihadist Islam, and between the other great religions, and here's how. Three of the great belief systems of the world were set up around 800 BC, a long time ago, 1,400 years before Islam was set up. One of them was Judaism, which led to Christianity, and the Old Testament is genocidal. Another of these belief systems was the Western system from Greece, and that was set up around the Iliad and the Odyssey. Those were the two founding documents, and that book is genocidal. Another in India was Hinduism, which was set up with the Vedas, another genocidal set of books. But what these books have in common and what differentiates them from militant Islam is that these books had a limited amount of territory in mind. They kept their genocide within a limited scope. Not that any genocide is acceptable. It is not, period, no matter how limited it might be. But the Old Testament was focused on a postage stamp-sized piece of land about the sixth the size of New York State, Israel. The Iliad was genocidal because when the Mycenaeans, the Greeks, win the war against the Trojans, what do you think they do? They kill every single male. They take every baby from a woman who is still impregnable, you know, who's still sexually attractive. They bash its head up against the walls, and they march off taking the women as sex slaves, having killed all the men in the town, basically pulling off a genocide. And the Vedas are all about the Indo-Europeans, the Aryans who invaded India about 1200 BC, about them marching into India and making war against the demons. Well, who are the demons that they are trying to utterly annihilate? The Dravidians, the people who lived in India, the indigenous people of India, who are darker in color than they are. But again, that is there's a limited amount of territorial ambition in the Iliad. It's to take one city. There's a limited amount of territorial ambition in the Vedas. It's to take India. Now, India is big, but it's not the world. In 629 AD, 1,400 years later, Muhammad sat down and he wrote his letters to the emperors. And he basically told every emperor he could get his hands on, with the exception of the emperor of China, either it was an invitation to Islam, either you accept my invitation or I'll be forced to use other means, military means. Muhammad said that God sat him down in 629 AD and brought the ends of the earth near to each other so that he could see that he would possess the entire globe. So when you see ISIS at work doing genocidal things, when you see Boko Haram in Africa doing genocidal things, when you see Al-Qaeda doing genocidal things, when these people talk about the fact that it could take 4 million deaths in the United States through the use of dirty nuclear weapons to bring the United States around, when the kid in Ohio says that it may take the deaths of billions to bring us all around to Islam. This is a territorial ambition, a global ambition, a planetary ambition that was set forth by Muhammad in 629 AD, and no previous or religion, no religion before then and no religion since has ever had that kind of absolutely encompassing vision of its of the fact that it will take over the world. It must take over the world because the whole world belongs to God, because God made the world from a clot of mud, and he made all of humans, you and me, from a clot of blood, and that means that God's law is the law that must rule us, and there is only one law of God, and that's Sharia.
Well, that sounds like the bad news. What can we do about it? I mean, what's the good news? It can't be that much doom and gloom.
No, it's not that much doom and gloom. The people, like my friends within the Muslim community, are wonderful. They are absolutely phenomenal. And they are victimized by the dark side of Islam more than you and I are. The people who are being killed every day in car bombings all over the place are not you and me, they're fellow Muslims. And these people need a voice, and there are several people trying to give them a voice. One is Ayan Hirsi Ali at Harvard. She originally came from Somalia. She grew up as a jihadist, and she changed her mind. And she went Western, and she became a member of parliament in Holland. And then she made a film about the violence against women in Islam. She made it with a guy named Theo van Gogh, the great-great-grandson of Vincent van Gogh's brother. And because of it, Theo van Gogh was sliced to pieces on the, while he was bicycling down the streets of Amsterdam with a big manifesto pinned to his chest. So she's now in the United States. But she wants the kind of reformation in Islam that we've had in Christianity. In 1517, Martin Luther had the guts to go up to the big wooden doors of the cathedral at Wittenberg and pin 95 theses to the cathedral door. And that changed Christianity. It took 100 years of, or 150 years of incredible bloodshed, but eventually it just changed the face of Christianity. She wants to do that with Islam. She wants to wipe out the dark parts, the murderous parts, and focus on the positive parts. There's another woman, Asra Nomani. She grew up in India. She's also from a Muslim family. She spent 11 years as a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She wants to see reformation within Islam. But unfortunately, the Muslim community is controlled. Its voice is controlled by a group called the Muslim Brotherhood and front groups like the Council for American Islamic Relations and the Muslim Students Union. And the Muslim Brotherhood says the first principle of Islam is jihad and dying as a martyr. Well, that's awful. And these people are squashing people like Asra Nomani and people like Ayan Hirsi Ali. And it's up to you and me to stand up for these people, because roughly 40% of people in the Muslim community worldwide, which is 600 million people, do not want to have anything to do with this darker side of Islam. And they are brilliant, wonderful people, but they don't dare speak up, because anybody who does speak up outside of the United States has his throat slit. So we need to stand up for them. One day I spent 3 months teaching myself Dreamweaver in 2000 when my book Global Brain came out, and I built a very complex 27-page website. And then I started getting hits from the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. And at the time, I had a very wonderful person who I was stuck in bed for 15 years. That's when Art Bell first started talking to me. And I had this wonderful person who was, I don't know what you would call it, drive-in shrink. He would come to my home. And he was Muslim. And so I said to him, why am I getting these hits from the United Arab Emirates and from Saudi Arabia? Are they checking up on me? Because I'd been on the hit list already, the punishment list in 17 Islamic countries. And he said, no, you don't understand something. There are universities in the United Arab Emirates. There are universities in Saudi Arabia. There are wonderful, fantastic, brilliant professors at these universities. They can't open their mouth in their own community. You speak for them. Think about that, Jimmy.
Interesting.
That's A mind-blowing statement. Absolutely a mind-blowing statement. So I'm belling the cat, you know, by putting a big sign around the dark side of Islam, saying, avoid. This is something you must understand to defeat it, but you must get away from it. And the people who welcome that the most seem to be my Muslim friends.
Well, one of the interesting things about you and your book and other publishers and the cartoonist and the things that went down and with Charlie Hebdo, for example, where they, you know, stepped outside and just tried to use freedom of speech, but violent things happen. And you've got this book now, and you're speaking now on the radio. Are you ever paranoid? I mean, do you sleep with one eye open?
Well, remember, my background is in science, and what got me into science at the age of 10 was learning that there are two rules of science. I read this in a big book, and the first rule of science is the truth at any price, including the price of your life, and the second rule of science is look at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. And those two rules became my religion. So when it comes to truth, I don't care if they cut me down in the streets. I've been up against these groups since 1988. In 1988, Omni magazine, the science magazine, published an article for my first as yet unpublished book, The Lucifer Principle. And it was about violence, and it was about violence in Western culture and violence in Jewish culture and violence in Muslim culture. Well, their offices were picketed for 4 days by the American, I can never get this name straight, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. So for 4 days, there was this threatening presence in the lobby of an Omni magazine, and then a plane went down over Lockerbie, Scotland, a Pan Am flight, killing absolutely everybody on board, and it was done by a Muslim terrorist. And this group was, it would have been incredibly embarrassing for them to continue sit-down striking in that lobby. And that's when I was put on the hit list or the punishment list in 17 Islamic countries. Then in 1998, the Council for American Islamic Relations, which is considered a terrorist group, it's been put on a terrorist list by the United Arab Emirates, who should know what they're talking about. They went to my publisher, Grove Atlantic, for my first book and said, you've got to take this guy's book out of print. You've got to make sure that he never publishes a book again. Otherwise, in the 57 Islamic countries, which have 1.6 billion citizens, you'll never sell another book again. And I basically, we fought that. And because, and the book stayed in print. The book has sold about 140,000 copies by now and is still selling strongly on Amazon.com. So I've been up against these people for a long time, and if they slit my throat, so be it. The truth is important. And when people tell you you can't write this book because you'll have your throat slit, that means nobody else but you is going to write it, and it's all the more important for you to get the information out.
Well, with ISIS specifically, I mean, directly at ISIS.
Right.
What I find interesting here is I'm not so sure it's that religious. You
it's
know,
very
I mean,
religious.
Well, if you understand what I'm saying, that,
yeah.
that you know, because it just seems to go against the grain of the very basic principles of humanity.
Right.
And that's my issue.
Well, if you pick up, and sometimes you should, you focus on hidden agendas and alien minds. Well, there are alien minds on Earth. One of them is the Islamic militant alien mind. Another is the Chinese mind, which I've never been able to crack the code of. But if you pick up their magazine, Dabiq, which has now been renamed Rumia, you'll see that every article starts with quotes from the Hadith and the Quran. Every
right.
single article, and running through the article, are all kinds of references to the stories that are in the Muhammad Code. How does a prophet brought you ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Boko Haram, or how Muhammad invented jihad? The very stories. Because Muhammad's life is the very pattern for holiness. So these people are very, very true to the dark side of Muhammad.
Well, I get that. No, I get that. I understand that.
Right.
I guess my statement was a little bit misunderstood. What I mean is the morals are missing in ISIS. That's what I'm saying. And that doesn't feel too religious to me as an outsider looking in.
Well, you have to remember it's an entirely different moral system. The moral system says you cannot kill other Muslims. But there are Muslim hypocrites. You can kill those. And so they're killing all kinds of other Muslims. There are Muslim apostates, and you can kill those. So they're killing all kinds of what they consider to be Muslim apostates. But it is a holy deed, and it is the epitome of pleasure and ecstasy to kill unbelievers.
Wow.
And
wow.
So the very height of holiness comes in killing you and me. The very height of holiness, the very epitome of morality comes from killing you and me.
Well, how do they recruit somebody that's not non-Muslim? That's what I find interesting.
Because they've got this worldview, which we can go into some other time. We've only got a few minutes left. But it's a total worldview, and it says, and this is something you'll recognize from early Christianity. It says that life on earth is pitifully short, but it's a prelude. It's a test. It's like an SAT test. It's an SAT test to see where you will go for infinity. And infinity, eternity, is either hell or heaven. And if you do the right things in this life, you'll have an infinite payoff, eternity in paradise. If you do the wrong things in this life, you will have an equal infinity of the greatest pain you can possibly imagine, being roasted over a spit until your skin, you're screaming and your skin falls off, and then you're given another skin by God.
Well, Howard, before we run out of time, I totally get that, and I understand it, but what I don't understand is why it is so effective. For instance, if you were reading this propaganda, would you fall for it?
I wouldn't fall for it.
Right.
The reason it's effective is because Muhammad did something no previous prophet had done. He put sex in paradise.
Right.
So
I can see that too.
Deprived as you were as a young man, and you know as young men, we are all sexually deprived, even the most gorgeous of us. You will get your 72 virgins, and that is in the holy books, the 72 virgins. And they will pay attention only to you, and they will remain virgins forever, no matter how many times you sleep with them, and their breasts will remain high, and it's a Playboy and Penthouse offer, and it's in heaven.
Right.
What an incredible innovation.
Well, somebody's going to be surprised. And you know what's what's really interesting for me is when you hear a neighbor or a friend, it doesn't matter what country, right? He was such a nice boy.
Yeah.
But he took the bait.
And the Ohio State killer was reading all the propaganda, and the propaganda just points out one massacre after another of Muslims. And there are lots of massacres of Muslims taking place around the world. There are lots of massacres of all kinds of people. And it exaggerates them, and in particular, right now the Muslims are being given a horrendous time that we are not doing anything about and we don't cover in Burma.
Right.
And their villages are being burned down. Their women are being raped. They are being driven out of Burma. When they go from Burma, they go to Bangladesh, which is a Muslim country. And guess what that Muslim country does to these poor refugees? It turns them around on their boats and sends them back to Burma, where they are being slaughtered. And this guy at Ohio State believed that the United States, which has nothing to do with this, was responsible for it.
Yeah.
What set him off.
I had read that. Well, before we do run out of time, is there a way we can wrestle control of Twitter and Facebook and YouTube? Why is it that they seem to be able to do whatever they want? We've only got about 30 seconds left, Howard.
Find your Muslim friends who you think are wonderful, decent people, support them in every way you can, and help them find a public voice, including voices on Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook.
There you go. Howard, what's up next for you? Oh, where can everybody get the book?
The book is at Amazon.com. It's been the number one new release on Islam and Muhammad for the last 9 days or something like that. It's only been out a few days. Or they can go to howardbloom.net and look me up.
There you go. Howard, thank you so much. Very entertaining conversation. And I'm always learning, and that's what you're here for. Thank you so much, Howard.
Jimmy, it's a pleasure.
Absolutely. Howard Bloom. Coming up next, Ralph Ellis is going to join us. And I need everybody to stay on focus, stay on point. Ralph Ellis is a first-time guest here on Coast to Coast, and he's one of the best. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Ralph Ellis, right after this break. Stay with us.